Campus FM i prezenta Campus Cocktail. I prezenta Father Joe Butch.
Fader Joe Butch nisa nilkom, nistin nilkom għall-edizzjoni oħra tal-programm Campus Cocktail, s-soltu nitkellem għan jessim l-Università. Illum ħana mill-eċezzjoni nitkellem għan persuna li ġiet l-Università. Ġiet l-Università u biex titkellem għan l-studenti, jessima Oriana Zil de Granados. And I welcome you to the program. I was just making a very general introduction to the program.
Thank you.
Oriana is a journalist with a vast experience. We'll be talking about some of her works during this interview. She produced a number of programs, Maestra Familia, one of them. She has produced two different television organizations and networks, and now she is the productions director at the Center for Investigative Reporting. What is the Center for Investigative Reporting?
Well, the center was founded 30 years ago, and the goal was to provide a home and an organizational structure for journalists who were mostly operating as freelancers, mm-hmm. Doing stories on their own and selling them to big outlets like the New York Times, Washington Post, magazines, and doing television documentaries. So the idea was that we would group together to provide help for each other and a legal background in case you got sued for libel or some mm-hmm. other legal issues, and also to provide health insurance and important things that, you know, we as journalists need.
So it's a kind of cooperative.
Exactly.
Almost.
It was started as a cooperative. Now, 30 years later, we have done 20 documentaries for PBS Frontline, which is one of the premier shows in the United States. Mm-hmm. And we regularly publish books and magazine articles and newspaper articles and a lot of radio. We do a lot of both short radio stories and long form.
So basically your work has to do with television, radio, and the print media.
Yes, although my responsibilities are primarily for television.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I was reading and researching on the internet about you, so, and I found this quotation. You were being interviewed by Elizabeth Pepin, and you said, "There is a war going on all over California that we feel has not been covered adequately by the mainstream media." You were referring, and we'll talk about it later on, you were referring about the gang war. But my question is different. We'll come to Nuestra Familia in a minute. My question is, why do you think the networks were not interested in covering this, from a journalistic point of view, very good story?
It's a great question. I think that ultimately the networks, the local news and the networks tend to get into a pattern of behavior where they're covering mm-hmm. things that happened that day, or if there was a shooting, they would cover a shooting, but they don't ever have time, really, to look at the larger issue behind it and try to give the audience a sense of why this was happening. And it's unfortunate that that's true. The networks previously used to put more time and effort into long-form kind of investigative, but really looking at the root causes behind problems, and they just don't do it anymore. So we try to come in and fill that gap, and mm-hmm. we can't do it, unfortunately, in every subject area, but in this it's a good example where you're going to see on the nightly news, so-and-so was murdered by so-and-so. You're going to see maybe a short 30-second report about murders, but you never see a longer report that explains the history of the gangs, why they fight each other. These are people doing this, and it's pretty easy to say, oh, those are just gang members. We don't want to report on them. But actually, when you do the reporting, you find that there's a lot of kids that are getting hurt in this process, and it's really important that society does something to prevent it.
Is it a commercial decision by the networks?
Yes, I think it is a commercial decision, and part of it has to do with the fact that most networks are now owned by big corporations, and previously the idea behind television was that there should be some public service. And actually the U.S. government gave for free the power to broadcast to the four major networks in the United States. And, you know, they gave them the broadband, the area on the spectrum to broadcast in exchange for the idea that they would do some public service. That, unfortunately, has been shrinking over the last 20 years as more and more corporate ownership is concerned about the bottom line and about making money, which means they're going to cut costs and they're going to do things for as cheaply as they can.
So, from what you say, can one conclude that what's happening is that the more the media become commercialized, looking at the bottom line, full stop, period, the less they really serve people, population.
Yeah, I think that is, unfortunately that is the case, that the more privatized and the more commercialized the ownership has become, the less good the news has become. And not only just good, but also really in depth. They don't do the in-depth work. They're going to put on television the images that they think will get the most viewers and keep them there so that they can get the ad revenue. That's not always the most important story. So there's a joke, if it bleeds, it leads. Mm-hmm. You know, you've probably heard that before.
Yeah.
But basically it means...
Unfortunately, it's true.
Yeah. I mean, it means, and the other thing is fires. Like, you'll often have a disproportionate coverage of fires on local news stations because the images are very powerful, but there aren't that many fires. So mm-hmm. you're kind of getting this idea that your society or your town is more dangerous than it actually is.
Yeah, but when one considers the effect of the media, not only on the pockets of the entrepreneurs, which is lining them more and more, but the effect that media has on our symbolic universe, the way we perceive the world, how we organize the world, whether we think that we are living in a safe world or in an unsafe world. So the media is touching people's presence and futures. Don't you think that then society should do something about it?
Yes, I do, actually. I think particularly in my society, a lot of news is aimed at scaring you. And so people walk around really fearful, and they actually have an exaggerated sense of the dangers that actually exist. And I think that's terrible, and it's changed our society. And I guess my organization is one small way that we try to do something about it, to do something about the problem. You know, there are other things happening. There's movements across the United States right now to start new nonprofit media organizations that will do better reporting. And so hopefully that will gain ground.
Okay, let's go to Nuestra Familia. Is it a documentary or is it a piece of investigative journalism? Where do you draw the line between the two? If a line can be drawn, because today we are living in an industry where lines are blurred more and more.
I mean, most of my work tends to be investigative reporting, where I'm using documents, I'm interviewing insiders, I'm trying to get people to talk who wouldn't normally talk, and using a lot of government sources. And in this example, in Nuestra Familia, we used a huge amount of documents that... we had to decide, okay, well, how are we going to get the documents on television without being really boring?
Mm-hmm.
So I would really call Nuestra Familia half and half. Half of it is really a story about a family. It's a father who unfortunately raised his son to be a gang member because he was a gang member and he was very young when he had his son.
These are true living people.
These are true people. They were willing to tell us their story, and we wove their life stories, the father and the son, through the whole documentary. And then interwoven with that was the more investigative aspects of the story, which was that we looked at a major government case against the Nuestra Familia gang, and we found irregularities about how the government had conducted their case, particularly using an informant who was a very violent, questionable man to be using as an informant. Very, very manipulative, and I believe he actually manipulated the government and everyone he came into contact with. And he got out of jail because he helped with this case. So we tried to expose the fact that this was, first of all, not necessarily a trustworthy informant, and second of all, that he, you know, that that wasn't exactly right, that he got to get out of jail free card for doing things that I'm not sure made a real difference in the end.
Okay, so I guess there you are mixing the human element together with the more wide social and societal implications of what's happening.
Yeah.
And then you have, so you are going, you are giving a big picture.
Yeah, I mean, I was, what I tried to do was tell a story that, mm-hmm. that teaches people a lesson about these gangs. I think with this documentary, I probably tried to do too much, because not only are we telling the story of the father mm-hmm. and the son, we also tried to tell the history of the gang. Then we tried to tell the informant story,
mm-hmm.
and we also tried to kind of show what it was like to be a gang member on the street.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, that's a lot for 1 hour. I often questioned my own, you know, decisions in editing this to put so much in.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in the end it works. It's a very busy documentary. There's a yeah, lot of okay. movement.
I guess in a documentary like this, or in a piece of investigative journalism like this, you will be faced all the time with a number of ethical decisions.
Yeah.
I guess, for example, how I'm going to protect my sources. Did you feel these problems, and how did you tackle them?
Yes, many times. we had, in this documentary, I actually interviewed a mother and her three sons, and she was going to be my main character. All three sons were gang members, and the mother had a lot of drug problems, and
mm-hmm.
she opened up her life to us, and we filmed her for 3 months. And
mm-hmm.
then one of her sons was threatened, and she wanted to back out. And so, of course, I already had a release signed from her. So then I had a big ethical dilemma, is do I put her on camera anyway and her sons on camera because she already signed the release, or do I respect her request? And, of course, in the end, I decided to, respect her request to withdraw. But it was a big problem for me.
I think many wouldn't, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, most journalists probably in the U.S. Mm-hmm. today would not have made that choice.
Mm-hmm.
I did, because I didn't want her to be hurt, and she could have been hurt. And it was very hard for me. It took another year to get another family to agree to go on camera and to really open up to us. And even so, that family had a lot of second thoughts, and we had to, you know, we had to try to develop a system to that we thought that, that the man who's the father in the story would be safe and would not be, you know, reciprocated against. He has received death threats since the documentary came out, but nothing's happened.
Yeah. Did you consider the possibility of having actors do the, what they were saying would be what the other said, but actors doing it? Did you consider that possibility?
Yeah, I have in the past done what we'd call mm-hmm. recreations,
yes,
using actors.
Reenactments.
But it not for this kind of documentary. I don't think it would.
And it's
worked.
Not as effective either.
Yeah, it's not as effective. I mean, you know, there's a lot of lines in every documentary that you have to make decisions on a case-by-case basis. I didn't feel that actors would work for this, but mm-hmm. I have done that in the past.
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes
mm-hmm.
it does work, particularly for historical documentaries mm-hmm. where there's no other way to do it. But if there is a way to do it with real people, I always think, mm-hmm. I always go for the, you know.
So when you were doing this, your documentary, did you had to cooperate or discuss or... I don't have a relationship with the police.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, as a journalist, look at relations with police?
Well, it depends on the police. Some police are very helpful and very honest, and
mm-hmm.
they'll, be extremely helpful and direct and cooperative. And other times, police are very uncooperative, and
mm-hmm.
they don't want to help you. In this documentary, mm-hmm. it was particularly challenging because several of the people that we were interviewing were criminals and could have been arrested by the police. So, we had to make decisions regularly about not reporting crime to the police. We had,
mm-hmm.
we had very early on images that we recorded of a guy selling drugs in his garage and doing drugs in front of us and having 4 illegal firearms in his garage. Now, some people might have reported that to the police, but this was one of our sources, so we didn't. We didn't report it to the police. I think had we found out that he was going to murder someone or something like that, we might have reported it to the police. You know, we had to think long and hard about where our own line was and how to develop a kind of a strategy so that we we're following our own ethical guidelines. And in the end, we never reported that man, but he was arrested anyway because he's an idiot and he got into trouble, you know, as they all do. So
one of the discussions that there are in journalism today is between being attached or detached. Sort of the traditional position was that you are a journalist, you are totally detached. But I guess in this kind of work, is detachment possible or is it even desirable?
Yeah, I don't really believe in detachment. I have thought a lot about it. It's a very good question. I don't really believe that I can separate my own kind of moral compass from my work and even my own viewpoints. I don't necessarily try to. I mean, I am very careful about always interviewing both sides. So if I have an accusation against the FBI, for example, as in this project, I'll go to them and I'll say, I want your side of the story. Tell me what you say. And I make every effort to try to include both sides of the story. But you can't always have this kind of balance that is not really I kind of call it fake balance sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's this idea of he said, she said. Oh, first we'll hear from this person, then we'll hear from this person. Mm-hmm. It doesn't always work, and it doesn't always represent the truth. So in what I do, I always try to find the truth.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It might be mm-hmm. my own version of the mm-hmm. truth, but mm-hmm. it's the truth that I believe
exactly.
in, and that's what I portray.
And I think that the idea behind detachment sometimes can involve the lack of responsibility. Because let's say if there is a product which we believe is dangerous. I don't think that as a journalist you can say, I did my duty. I interviewed the importer who told me it's okay, and I interviewed someone else who told me that it's not okay. I think you should investigate to see whether it's okay or not.
I agree completely. I actually did a documentary last year where I was the senior producer, I wasn't the producer, mm-hmm. about global warming. And one mm-hmm. of the issues that we came up against was because CNN and other mainstream channels had been, for years, had been putting on the global warming scientists mm-hmm. and then the global warming doubters.
Yes. Uh-huh.
They gave equal weight to both mm-hmm. sides. So the public was confused. The public mm-hmm. thought, well, maybe it's true and maybe it's not, because these two people had equal weight. But it turned out, in the end, they're giving equal weight to someone who was not scientifically accurate, mm-hmm. was not, you know, generally scientists of the top level of scientists. They were being paid by the mm-hmm. oil and gas and coal industry to say these things. And so we, as part of the documentary, we uncovered that and the intrinsic unfairness of this, you know, equal mm-hmm. time for both sides of the story when one was clearly biased and wrong.
So. You've just mentioned this example, and you were saying that the pro and con position, giving you the feeling that they are being fair, can be very unfair. Because in this case, the person saying, no, nothing to worry about, was someone in the pay of big business. How much do you think, in the United States in particular, is big business influencing news content?
Well, big business owns the news in my country, and that's so they have a huge mm-hmm. influence over news content. I think that there is traditionally they do try to create a firewall between the corporate ownership and mm-hmm. the actual content of the news. So they're not supposed to influence it, but they own mm-hmm. the stations. So you know, just imagine, you know, if you own the station, you're going to have some influence. I think there are a lot of really good, very, very talented journalists working at these stations, doing their hardest to produce the good news stories. But there's going to be a tendency to go for ratings. And ratings are important, but sometimes people don't know, you know, sometimes people watch stuff because they want to relax at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they need to be watching other things. Mm-hmm. And part of the job I see from the news media is it's our job to help people become informed over topics that maybe are painful and hard to watch. And they don't want to watch it all the time. But guess what? It's still important. to our society. Mm-hmm. So I really think there has to be a balance there. You can't just do everything based on ratings.
Yes, exactly. And being fair towards an audience, as you say, I think implies also trying to educate the audience. I don't want to sound paternalistic, but if we take the analogy with food, junk food, people like to eat junk food, but I think there is a whole now army of people trying to educate, persuade, cajole people not to eat junk food, but to eat good food. And I think, again, even with the media, people love to see junk media, but I think our responsibility is to try and move people away from junk media to something more substantial that has more quality. I was reading about the United States recently, a study that there was, but I did not read the actual study. Now, one of the trends, it seems, in newsrooms is that you don't just receive a press release, but you receive a press release with the video and the clips, etc., etc. And then the study was showing how stations are using this without telling people that this is what the organizing of the event said. I think that's another example how people can be misled by the media.
Yeah, those are called video news releases, and it's mm-hmm. a huge problem, particularly in small local stations. Mm-hmm. So they're a small market. They don't have a lot of money to do their own reporting, and they're putting these video news releases on as if they were news, just recutting it or putting their newscaster's voice over it. But it's not news, and it's made by a corporation mm-hmm. to advance their product or whatever it is. It's terrible.
In Malta, when you have people in newsroom have limited resources, so it can be that even a political party would organize an activity, and then they would send either just a press release, and in some cases perhaps even visual footage with the press release, and the station or the paper would make a report based on the press release given by the political party without saying that this is based on the press release. And I think people get the impression that the medium had its people there when it didn't have its people there.
Right.
Another program that you did is that is different. Your programs are all socially propelled, so to say. There is a social soul in your work. Something which contrasts also with, I don't know whether I'm correct or not, but with the American spirit of neoliberal capitalism. Mm-hmm. Why did this subject interest you?
Well, I've always been extremely interested in the death penalty. I mean, mm-hmm. I think it's a major, when you're going to decide as a society that it's okay to kill someone, my view is this is extremely controversial, it's extremely difficult, and it has to be done with the utmost care. And it has to be constantly observed by the media and other people to make sure it's being done fairly. And what the conclusion of this story was that, in fact, it is not being done fairly, and different states have different rules and different amounts of money that they're putting for the defense of people who are on death row. And generally, these people, unfortunately, are mentally ill and have had horrific backgrounds themselves. So there's some incredible stories that, mm-hmm. that we found as part of doing this work. And I think it's a really important show because there's a lot of people in the United States who are pro death penalty just blindly. They just say, okay, mm-hmm. I'm for it. I want this person, I want someone to pay. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important to get into the details because it's not just as simple as they should pay for what they did. You know, it's really complicated, the legal battle kind of that goes on to prove whether this person is guilty and mm-hmm. then to prove whether they deserve death.
I think that I was persuaded to be against death penalty by a film by the Polish director Kieślowski. Mm. He has this series of fantastic films. I have a course about these films at the university called The Decalogue. And number 5 is about murder and the death penalty. And after seeing that, you say, murder is horrible. But then you say the death penalty is even worse, because it's not administered by a criminal, but it's being administered by the state. And Kieslowski's film was a very, very strong social comment. Let me continue on this topic, and perhaps this is an unfair question, because I think effects, it's always very difficult to gauge effects. But after a program like this is aired, and I guess it would perhaps do the rounds in other areas, do you ever have reactions from people?
I mean, some of my work gets a huge reaction and mm-hmm. actually causes change in law or, mm-hmm. you know, real reform. Other work doesn't have mm-hmm. huge, doesn't feel like it has a mm-hmm. huge impact. We always try at our organization, we have someone who does extra outreach with our work. So we'll try to send a copy of this piece, for example, to lawmakers who are making the decisions about whether to change the law.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll try to carry on and really put...
So you do a lot of advocacy also,
yes.
together with the...
Yes, it's not really advocacy. It's mm-hmm. more education.
Yeah, okay.
We just really want to put the films and the reports we uh-huh. do in the right hands, and mm-hmm. which is the hands of the people who are going to actually be changing the law.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have an extra special effort usually after a show to do that. In this instance, with Death is Different, it got picked up by a lot of advocacy organizations mm-hmm. who are opposed to the death penalty, and they have been sending it out to lawmakers, et cetera. So I hope that people will be educated. I know that, you know, the states that have the worst laws we showed was Alabama and Mississippi, and they haven't changed their law since the short story aired. But maybe now they know that it's a problem.
Okay. I guess you would say that you have to work with small budgets. Malta is a much smaller country, and the word small is very relative, because a very small elephant is larger than a very large rat. So I guess our small would be smaller than your small. Programs like this, Maestro Familia, or that is different. What kind of budget would you be working in, and what are the time frames?
An hour-long show like Maestro Familia can be anywhere. It can take, the shortest it would take is 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And that's to do the research, the filming, and that's sort of if you have a full budget and you have already raised the money,
mm-hmm.
you could do it in about 6 months. That film took 3 years
mm-hmm.
To do, because we didn't have the money right up front. And it was a very low budget. I'd say total it was about $225,000,
mm-hmm.
Which may seem like a lot of money, but because you have to pay numerous mm-hmm. people yeah. over a period of a year or more, it isn't actually that much money. But a Frontline, for example, an hour-long show is more, is about twice that, 500 to 600,000.
Okay. Thanks very much for your comments. Bikin et Oriana Zil de Granados, li kienet iżur l-Universitat tagħna, ġurnalista Amerikana li magħha tkellimna mhux biss dwar ix-xogħol tagħha, ma dwar diversi aspetti etiċi tax-xogħol tagħha u tal-medja in ġenerali. Grazzi ħafna tal-attenzjoni, niltaqgħu ġimgħa dieħla ma' mistieden jew mistiedna oħra interessanti. Saħħa.
Campus FM għadu kemm waslilkom Campus Cocktail. Produzzjoni u preżentazzjoni Father Joe Borch.